Committee meeting to order. It is the department's open house for today. We have a full agenda all day long, and since we're on, it's 09:30. Commissioner, could you please introduce yourself and begin the meeting?
Good morning, Chairman Herron. I'm Bob Dole, Deputy Commissioner for the State of Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. On behalf of the DMVA and Commissioner Hummel and Governor Walker, I want to thank the committee for scheduling this meeting and giving us an opportunity to visit with you all and to take some time to let you know what's going on with our programs during the session that, frankly, is a challenge because of all the time constraints we're all struggling with. So we really appreciate this opportunity to address all your concerns and let you know where we're going as a department. It's a great opportunity to do this event this week because many people come to Anchorage for AFN, so the timing is with us. That's the good news. The bad news is AFN is on this week as well, which is why Commissioner Hummel is not here. She, along with Governor Walker, is appearing before an AFN conference this morning dealing with building better relationships between the state of Alaska government and the tribes. So she sends her regrets that she is not here with us today for this. You will hear mostly from the Army and Air Component commanders and the division directors giving the specifics of their programs today. This is going to be a PowerPoint non-existent day, so we're not going to inflict PowerPoint on you, but rather want to engage in a dialogue and find out what concerns you have about our programs and tell you what we're doing and what we're excited about and doing with them. And we're prepared to drill down into as much detail as you want today in looking forward as we're going forward. As you know, we have various divisions that do various things. We have the service components, the Air and Army National Guard. We have the Alaska State Defense Force. And I think they'll have some exciting news for you today. We have Division of Homeland Security Emergency Management. We have the Alaska Military Youth Academy. And we have our small but very effective Office of Veterans Affairs. We do a variety of things for Alaskans. And the way we're able to leverage doing so much, frankly, is what we do is much of it's contingent on federal mission and federal resources. You can see we call it the iceberg graphic we left up there. The long and short of it is we leverage about $15 million in general fund to bring in about $500 million to the Alaskan economy from the federal government across our various programs. And that's how we're able to do so many programs there. And I'll also be talking briefly about our priorities and the Walker-Mulott administration priorities for rural Alaska and a more effective engagement there than we have had as a department in the past. For us as a department implementing our programs, we start as we have three areas of priorities. That's the graphic before you of the three rings. Those rings are, first, Arctic strategy. The Arctic is changing. It's a place of vital national interest. It's a place of vital state interest. We just had our commander-in-chief, the president, up here because of that. We recognize as a department we need to be on the front line driving that discussion. We have engaged with Senator Sullivan's staff in terms of the amendment added to the National Defense Authorization Act to require the Department of Defense to identify and resource and fund a national strategy for the Arctic. We are also full up engaged in developing that Arctic strategy that makes sense both for Alaskans and for our nation. The second area of commitment to us is engagement with our Alaskan communities. That is all our communities, from the most rural Alaskan community to every part of every urban community or neighborhood as well. We realize as a department we need to reach across all of those. We need to enhance our third area of priority is emergency preparedness capacity, and we need to grow that capacity. The events of this summer, the unheralded fire season, the storms without sea ice all show that emergency management capacity must be grown in this state to do right what we need to by Alaskans. And as we all know, we're out of money, so it's time to think. We got to find ways to do this very cost effectively. If we think of those three rings, we see the bullseye of that as rural engagement. And in order to be effective in these, we have to engage more effectively in rural Alaska. All of our divisions have been tasked with doing that, and they will tell you about the things they're doing, from enhancing the Tribal Veterans Representative Program to provide more access for vets across Alaska to services, to mission growth for the Alaska State Defense Force, to other efforts we have underway to address those issues across the entity. And doing that, we will do right by Alaskans, and we'll do it in each of those areas within our areas of responsibility. I'm not going to talk at you for the sake of talking at you, so if you don't have any more questions of me, I'm going to invite up the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Yes, Representative, to the chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
You mentioned Senator Sullivan's amendment. I'd like a copy of the amendment. I'd like to know the status. Can you tell us any more about it? I'd like to see the text and what the status is, please.
Okay, Section 1043 of the National Defense Authorization Act was one that we provided substantial advice and assistance in terms of crafting it to meet the needs of what makes sense for Alaska. In doing that, what it does is it requires the Department of Defense to develop a operations plan for the Arctic, as they have for other places like the defense of Korea or for war in the Middle East. And doing that, they also have to identify the forces to support it. In doing that, in making them identify and resource forces and make sure, say, if they need land forces or army soldiers capable of operating in the Arctic, that they actually fund and provide those rather than taking one of the two Arctic-capable brigades out of Alaska and cutting their capacity by 50%. This was introduced at the committee. It was one of just a handful of amendments that actually were accepted to the NDAA. At that point, it's been passed by the Senate, passed by the House. It's sitting on the President's desk. This round of the NDAA will probably be vetoed for other reasons in terms of how the funding differences of opinion and how the our national defense should be funded between the legislative and executive branches. However, this particular provision passed in both the Senate and House versions.
May I follow up briefly?
Sure, go ahead.
Which committee was it added in, Armed Services or Appropriations?
It was introduced in Armed Services, which Senator Sullivan sits on it.
And finally, is there a provision in there requiring that they confer or consult or work with the Alaska state government, particularly the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs and National Guard? Is that in the amendment itself?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, that exact language is not in the amendment. Consistent with the doctrine of how operations plans are developed, we would expect that consultation to happen, though. And functionally, because of the role DMVA, the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, plays up here, where we own the search and rescue forces of Alaska, we're a major shareholder of the air transport mission up here. We own the air defense surveillance missions. They have to consult us to go forward on that. We do those, not active duty up here, Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Gruenberg, I was just in D.C., and I was Senator Sullivan briefed me on the amendment. But more specifically to your question is, we can ask the Deputy Commissioner to write a memo to Senator Sullivan, making sure that that's understood. And, of course, Senator Sullivan is here for Alaska Federation of Natives. And when I get a chance to visit with him, I'll specifically ask him to make sure that that is clearly understood, that there is a working relationship with the state of Alaska.
Mr. Chair, would it be in order, would you appreciate, so we can have on the record a motion by the committee that it's on behalf of the full committee and we do exactly what you want. Do you want that?
Motion's in order.
So moved.
Okay. Seeing no objection, we will make sure that that is articulated to the senator and so that the department has it in writing.
Thank you. Thank you for doing that. Thank you both.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we move on to the particular and go down through the agenda and have the particular speakers, first of all, thank you all for being here. But I don't want to assume something, and it may be very obvious, but this sheet was, you kind of went over some of this as far as the overview. And as part of that overview, this is the vision. We've got the Arctic strategy, the emergency management, et cetera. That's the vision. So we have the federal mission. Could you tell me in a nutshell what the federal mission is since you carry that out? And is there a separate state mission? So we're talking mission, federal mission, state mission. Are they the same or what are they? Just so we get that as part of the overview, please.
Through the chair. Representative Hughes, the federal mission, basically, the generic language is where we receive federal funds to execute a specific federal purpose, we must comply with that federal purpose to execute those funds. For instance, in the Army Guard, we receive funds to organize, train, and equip the Army National Guard to deploy places to defend our nation as a land component. For the air component, besides being able to deploy places, we see federal funds to provide search and rescue services in Alaska to watch the skies for Russians trying to sneak in, to watch the space for missiles trying to being lobbed at the United States. For the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, they receive federal FEMA grant money for disaster mitigation and disaster relief. We enable, we've received federal funds through the Veterans Affairs Office for getting vets to services they need. Those are the federal ones, and there is a for carrying out federal missions or federal requirements that the federal government's responsible for, like our national defense. We also have separate state missions and state funds. For instance, for the Alaska State Defense Force, we're increasing the amount of money that we're allocating internally that we're spending on them to be there to help Alaskans in time of need when the normal law enforcement or other disaster response provisions require it. In the case of the Army National Guard, we have used state funds for firefighting, which is not a federal responsibility, but as a health and welfare thing, it's a state responsibility. And across the different divisions, we can look at the different areas there, because we have more Alaskans per capita than any other state in terms of attending to their needs. In the Office of Veterans Affairs, we spend state money for outreach events to take care of these Alaskans and their specific veterans' needs.
I'll follow up.
Please, go ahead.
And so there's not one overarching mission such as to ensure security for Alaskans or something? You don't have one overarching mission or?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, I think in terms of an overarching mission, it would be difficult to get one with the adequate specificity that does everything from the Alaska Military Youth Academy, where we provide a vector change for our most at-risk teenagers, to we look at preparing troops, having Alaskans ready to assist in disaster response, to helping veterans after they have done with that. So it's kind of a full spectrum or lifespan management from adolescents up through World War II vets. And we haven't yet, there's still something that catches the vast array of providing benefits and assistance programs to those who have stepped in harm's way for this great nation and this state, as well as making sure we have folks ready to do it now and through the AMIA process, developing those who could step up, too.
And Paul, well, thank you for that. It makes it a little trickier when you can't kind of always go back to one main thing, where other departments often is. They can, in one sentence, they can say their mission. So that's just good for us to know. Thank you.
Commissioner, before we ask Mike to speak, I'd like to, and of course yourself and Ron and Mike, know all the legislators, but I'd like to introduce all the legislators to the rest of staff. Is Representative Culver, who is from Matsu Valley and Interior Alaska, and Representative Hughes is from Palmer. My colleague, the dean of the legislature here, Representative Lynn is from Anchorage. And Representative Dave Talarico from Healy, Representative Tuck from Anchorage, Representative Grunsberg is from Anchorage as well, and myself, I'm from the Yukon-Kuskokwim region. My hometown is Bethel, and there's many staffers for other legislators that are in the audience, and so welcome to you all. And that's for the record, so please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, good morning, members of the committee. It's an honor to be here. It's good to see you. For the record, my name is Mike O'Hare. I'm the Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, part of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs family. I would also like to introduce my Deputy Director, Mike Sutton, in the back. Mike, thank you. Mr. Chairman, our mission is simple and complex. Our mission is to coordinate critical services to protect lives and property from terrorism and all other hazards, both natural and man-made. We have a strategy that we incorporate is to establish a culture of preparedness, enabling a swift coordinated response leading to a rapid comprehensive recovery. It's been a heck of a season. It's been a heck of a spring. It's been a heck of a summer, as we all know. Flooding of the Dalton Highway in the Arctic. We've had our, you know, Alaska's second largest wildfire season. We've all experienced those situations. The Sockeye Fire, of course, in Mattsu Borough, the Card Street Fire, and the Kenai. Communities evacuated. I mean, entire communities evacuated due to either smoke or fire threat. And those neighboring communities 35 miles away downriver being able to receive those. Not one fatality. And I compliment that to the success of a prepared, more prepared communities, more prepared organized boroughs to support those communities. We also, of course, had the fires in Kodiak and Chiniak, the mudslides in Sitka that took three lives. So it's been a heck of a season, and then fall is upon us. As we know, we have fall sea storms with no shore fast ice available, as the Deputy Commissioner had mentioned, to protect those communities from these hurricane force winds with no names attached to them, but hurricanes nonetheless. So we, on top of that, of course, we had an international Arctic conference here in Anchorage to support for coordinating security and protect those that are visiting and being good hosts, as well as a presidential visit and coordinating the security. So it's been a heck of a summer. It's been a heck of a spring. It's a heck of a fall, and we look forward to the missions at hand. I want to just go over briefly. I've testified before, but I just want to give you a quick overview of who we are, what we do, and how we do it, and where we're going in the future. So who we are, we're the lead disaster coordinating agency in Alaska for disasters. We partner with local state, our brothers, the National Guard and Alaska State Defense Force, federal agencies, Federal Emergency Management, United States Coast Guard, Department of Defense, utilizing several resources from DOD, pardon the acronym, we're trying to be an acronym-free group in this presentation, so Department of Defense with the individual readiness training, which is engineering and Army practice for that we've incorporated with the move from Utah and Metarvik. Anyway, coordinating resources to help Alaskans be better prepared, state, federal, local agencies. Also our faith-based, our nonprofits and faith-based, Salvation Army and Red Cross, faith-based organizations like Samaritan's Purse and Mennonite Disaster Services to help with the repair and recovery of those communities that are affected by disaster. And, of course, our tribal partners, Tanana Chiefs Conference, Association of Village Council Presidents. Those partnerships and organizations assist in not only the preparedness, outreach, response, and recovery of those communities. So it's great partnerships. That's how we do business. It's about the partnerships. And also with our private sector folks, critical infrastructure and key resources, water systems, power systems, food supply, is all private sector or nonprofit in those communities. We need to identify those cascading effects of what will go down and what will threaten those systems. So we are the lead disaster coordinating agency in Alaska. We're about 60 people, we're broken out in five sections. Of course, the operations section is the, I call it the sexy section. It's the most responsive on a daily basis to the communities. These are the folks in the State Emergency Operations Center that get the calls from those communities to either directly respond to help them assist in whatever threat or issue they're facing, whether it be power loss, whether it be a flood, fire, water system going out, and on a daily basis they coordinate those other agencies to help fix those problems, whether it be maintenance issues to the water supply or the power systems or a total devastation to a community, and what resources can they bring to bear to immediately affect stabilization of the situation before it becomes a disaster. So we're not the guys standing around with Nomex fire suits, I think was the statement, waiting to slide down a fire pole and go to work and fly out and respond. We're the lead coordinating agency to coordinate any resource available here in the state of Alaska and reach down the lower 48 and through our federal partners as necessary to respond and recover those communities that are affected by disaster. So that's our response, and it's our response section, but we're more than that. We're the preparedness group. We assist communities prepare for disasters, how to be prepared for spring floods, and how to be prepared for local emergency operations plans. We do outreach to communities, big and small. And we have, I have some outreach educational material out there. We have individual and family preparedness plans out there in your packets, which was actually an Anchorage neighborhood watch plan, which is great for any community. It's very easy to use. I encourage you to use it yourself and share it with your constituents. I have a bunch more for you if you need them. We also have, with regards to preparedness and outreach awareness, tomorrow, 10:15, at 10:15 is the Great Alaska Shakeout. Drop, cover, and hold is the takeaway from that. What to do in an earthquake, what not to do in an earthquake. I would encourage you to post the website and look at the website and register for it. We have over 126,000 citizens in Alaska registered for this. So at 10:15, on 10:15, everybody's going to drop, cover, and hold, and they're going to know what to do and what not to do in an earthquake. So this is some of the outreach material. We also have a planning section provides local communities and statewide emergency response plans. And I'll draw your attention to the red folders, if you don't mind, that have passed out. Some of you, if you wouldn't mind, pass them around. Those are called Small Community Emergency Response Plans, acronym SCERP. These are very, very easy to use, comprehensive plans on what to do during an event, whether it be a flood, fire, earthquake, whatever it is, who to call, what to say, where to call, who's in charge, and who's responsible. We are working these through with every community, every small community in Alaska, and having very effective results. These are very simple, easy, quick opportunities to get Alaskans better prepared for the threats and hazards that face them. We also have our planning section, as I said, that we also do disaster mitigation planning. Not only do we look at the threats, but how can we mitigate those communities and those issues, whether it be elevating for floods, elevating houses for floods, having communities establish their own mitigation plans, whether it be revetments or whatever it is. But investing money in to help mitigate, not just being reactive. The rule of thumb is for every dollar of mitigation money spent to invest for disaster mitigation, you save $10 in response and recovery money. So we feel it's a good investment, and planning is mitigation as well. So we also assess, as I said before, critical infrastructure and key resources. And then we have folks in what we call our disaster assistance section. After the disaster, these are the folks that work with the communities and the individuals who are affected by disaster to work the state and federal programs, those grant programs from FEMA, from the state of Alaska, to repair and rebuild their critical infrastructure and help those individuals impacted by disaster get back on their feet. We've got state individual assistance programs that are nationally renowned and funded through the Disaster Relief Fund that provide those individuals at least a step up to get back up to some semblance of normalcy. So very, very proud of these folks. Then we have our disaster, or we have our administration and grant support folks that work with us. So those are five sections, 60 of the greatest people in the whole wide world, but we can't do it alone. So it's all about partnerships, and those are the partnerships we talk about. I want to talk about, if you don't mind, and I know I'm kind of going on quick, but I've got 20 minutes and I could talk all day on this. So
if you have an extra one of that red packet, I could use one.
Yeah, Mike, I was going to suggest that this is a valuable document to have, and as an elected official, I wouldn't mind having my own copy from my community, and I would have suggested all other legislators may want to have it. So if you're at home and there's something bad happens, you can follow a guide as well.
Absolutely, sir. Mr. Chairman, absolutely. Be glad to get them for you. For individual and family preparedness, this is the easy kind of SCRP, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But for community leadership, that's the easy plan to work through. If the leadership is not in the community, and a lot of times in the smaller communities, when a disaster happens, the leadership's not there, and now the heck, what do we do now? Anyone can grab that operations plan and effect response. So be glad to provide copies and samples as necessary, sir.
Yeah, I would like one for my community, sure. Representative Hughes.
I have two short answer questions and then a comment, if that's okay, because I know we're on a time crunch. I'm just wondering how the earthquake preparedness exercise tomorrow compares with previous years and whether that's primarily school children involved as far as, I think you said 126,000. That's the first question.
May I answer that? Mr. Chairman, Representative Hughes, yes, the primary registrants are the school children.
Okay, good. I'm glad they're getting educated. I guess we need...
There's over just about 100,000 school kids that are registered.
That's great, and I know I was involved a little more last year trying to get more adults and businesses involved, and maybe I should have helped a little more this year because I do think it's a situation. Hopefully you have some contact, too, with Mike West, the UAF professor, very much, and I know he's having a conference about earthquakes coming up here shortly because we all know that there may be another big one. I'm wondering if FEMA... I understand FEMA may have money available for medical and security units in the event of a disaster. I wonder if we've tapped into that.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, we had our Alaska Shield 2014 exercise, which was in honor and in practice for the 1964 earthquake. We did that last year, very successful. And we actually exercised with our partners at Health and Social Services getting those catastrophic medical kits up here quickly. So Health and Social Services has received medical equipment, medical supply stations, and equipment from their federal counterparts. And we have a very good contact with FEMA and a system in place to get mass medical supply and mass medical systems up here very, very quickly.
And as follow-up to that, is there funding on an annual basis that would sustain, like, a medical unit kind of that would be ready and waiting in the event of a disaster? Is that incorrect on my thinking that might be available?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, the funding is not available. The systems and supplies and equipment are available at a moment's notice.
Okay. And then the last comment, just because I'm out where the Sockeye fire was, I heard from some nonprofits that were a little bit frustrated, and I know it gets kind of crazy when the Operations Center folks are doing the best they can, but there was instances where some of the nonprofits that wanted to help ended up kind of going around about way and doing it themselves because they got blocked. Perhaps they had food, that kind of thing to donate, and so I just encourage as a comment, you know, in between disasters, I'm sure you debrief and talk about how to improve things, but I think some of those things, the community is so willing to step up, and just if we have the network set up a little bit better so that they could feed into that without it getting all blocked up at the gateway there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hughes, I thank you very much for the statement. To answer the question and to make a counterstatement, if I may, Mr. Chairman, donations in a disaster or disasters in themselves sometimes, coordinating all of those, all that love that people want to bring forth to those affected communities, and it's warehouse fulls of love, and how do you organize and distribute that, whether it be food or clothes or whatever it is, money, to make that more efficient, I've hired a donations management individual to solely focus on coordinating all of the donations that come in for disasters and all of those good agencies and good people that want to give. So I hear you, Matt.
Mike, you brought up Tarvik and Newtok are some of the Marines used to say, newer talk. But could it, not at this time, but could I get a briefing on the plan for the last couple of years that's going to go forward?
Yes, sir. All right, just have one more, Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind, where we're going. So where we're going relates to just what you had mentioned. As the Deputy Commissioner had mentioned, our focus is on resilience, rural engagement and rural resilience. Every state in Alaska, every city and community in Alaska has a state emergency response plan. Have they taken it out and tested it, dusted it off and checked it out? Is it appropriate? Are the evacuation plans appropriate? The Kivalina plan, the Shishmaref plan, and so our focus is going to be on planning refreshes in those small rural communities and rural community engagement, outreach training and exercise and preparedness. We will continue mitigation opportunities in rural communities and look at more innovative mitigation opportunities in the rural communities. And with regards to Nutak and Natarvik, Mr. Chairman, there is a federal grant right now called the Community Development Block Grant. It's a competitive grant somewhere in the neighborhood of about $1 billion nationwide. The state of Alaska has successfully gone through phase one and on to phase two, the final part of this project, which will bring about $225 million of resilience projects to those communities affected in disasters from 2012 to 2014. And Nutak and Natarvik is on that work plan. This grant, this opportunity will help finish that project, sir. And I'd be glad to give you a more in-depth update, but we're very excited about it. This, what we call the CDBG grant, the Community Development Block Grant, is made for Alaska. It's looking at innovative opportunities. It's looking at diverse communities, and look forward to giving you a brief out on that. We're looking, as the Deputy Commissioner said, looking at Arctic development and adaptation and resilience, focus on the new critical infrastructure and key resources out there, ports, communications line, et cetera, and how they adapt to climate change and what are the cascading effects if they go down. We're also looking at enhancing emergency management with the resources and capabilities of our National Guard brothers and our Alaska State Defense Force brothers out in the communities. Having the ASDF, State Defense Force, be the eyes and ears, boots on the ground folks that can actually articulate very quickly what the real issues are out there and how we can address them rapidly. So tying on all those resources together and take advantage of Arctic and rural focus to enhance emergency management. That concludes my 50-cent tour, and I'm glad to entertain any questions, Mr. Chairman.
For the record, Representative Ledoux has joined us about 9:55. Is there any questions for Michael Hare? And Max, you got to take off for your...
Well, I'm not sure. Chris left, and I sent my staff to see. We're having a minority caucus, our weekly caucus, and I'm not sure. He may want me to be here rather than... Yes or no? He wants me to go. Okay, I'll be back.
All right. Okay. Thank you for your presentation. For the record, please state your name and your affiliation and begin with your presentation, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Forrest Powell, for the record. I am a program coordinator with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs representing the Office of Veterans Affairs, and I'm here on behalf of Bertie Bowen, our director. I wish to start out, sir, with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs numbers that they have for our veterans here in the state. There's 73,397 that are recognized by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Our mission with the Office of Veterans Affairs is to promote awareness, assist eligible veterans, active duty, guard, reserve, their families, and survivors to receive from the U.S. federal and state governments any and all benefits to which they are entitled under the existing or future laws that are enacted. Our vision with the Office of Veterans Affairs is to ensure that all veterans, active duty, guard, and reserve, and their families understand and be recognized that they are earned and are entitled to by expertly administering all current programs and anticipating future needs and taking appropriate action to meet their needs. Veterans Affairs core values. We hold ourselves personally and professionally accountable to deliver on America's promise to all eligible members we serve through courage, conviction, and on behalf of core values of integrity, compassion, commitment, and selflessness and teamwork. Our goal is serving Alaska one veteran at a time. This is what drives our 17 veteran service officers and four staff members in our office, who service over 73,000 veterans and their 154,000 dependents, plus our active duty and our guardsmen. The Office of Veterans Affairs, again, with four full-time staff members, are members of the 13-member Alaska Veterans Advisory Council. We serve as a committee member for the State Veterans Cemetery Planning. We also manage the Alaska Territorial Guard Program. We hold active duty discharges. Active duty discharges are just about as important as a birth certificate, or a marriage certificate, as my wife would say, when a service member discharges. That is what the veteran uses for their benefits or entitlements to benefits when they separate from service. The Office of Veterans Affairs holds copies, number 6, of all DD-214's discharge documents on file, so that should any veteran wish to get a copy, they can come to our office and we can provide them a copy of that DD-214. Prime example, yesterday we had a veteran that was getting a home loan and needed his DD-214, that discharge document, to show that he was honorably discharged, and we were able to pull it right there on the spot for him, only because he lost his, and of course, you hear many other stories of there was a fire and or flooding, or my ex-spouse took care of it for me. So we hold those on file for the veterans. That's how important those DD-214s are. So when you have a constituent, if you could please make sure they have their DD-214, they can contact us. And we'll make sure that we leave our phone number that so you can contact us immediately. We partner with over 250 tribal veterans representatives. We attend veterans town hall meetings. We attend indigent veterans funerals at the Jay Bear National Cemetery. We provide veterans memorial grant fund. We partner with the veteran service officers, again, 17 of them here in the state of Alaska. We manage highly rural transportation grants. We partner with the VA Rural Veterans Outreach Program. Our staff also partners with the veterans organizations and community agencies to prevent homelessness, provide services, and build connections that serve our veterans and our dependents throughout Alaska. Do quite a bit. Our office and what we do, with the 17 service officers and 4 staff members, 21 altogether, we ensured the return of $56 million in a single one-time payment owed to veterans that were eligible for veterans that were eligible and their family members. Ongoing annually, of course, this amount comes in. 2 years ago, it was $49 million. Last year, $56 million. And as you can tell, it's going up based on our 5% increase of veterans coming into the state of Alaska. 10% example I can give you is, if you have a veteran who has hearing loss that works on the flight line and or has an issue with ringing in the ears, they call it tinnitus, that's a 10% disability right off the bat. It's a presumptive. That veteran puts in for that, that's $133.17 a month that veteran receives. That's what we call the one-time payment. Now, that $133 in a village can feed a family. It could help a individual pay for fuel, pay for ammunition to go hunting, and then bring back something to feed the family. So that's how important this is when we talk about just a simple 10%. And if all 73,000 of our veterans had 10%, it would be amazing, but that's not the case. We personally assist 57,989 veterans, active duty, reserve component members, and family members with federal and state benefits, claims, questions, and processing. And that's just only 21 of us that do this.
Forrest, just excuse me, Representative Hughes.
Yes, thank you. You mentioned the $56 million coming in, the 73,000 veterans, and I think you said 154 dependents, which is one-third of Alaskans connected, either a veteran or connected. It's pretty amazing. But as far as the example of a person with a 10% disability and that $56 million coming in, out of those 73,000 veterans, how many are connecting with the services you provide? How many are untapped and probably aren't receiving the $133 a month? Or are pretty much veterans, if they know they have the possible ability to get in those programs, they're getting into them. Are there a bunch of Alaskans who just aren't connected and aren't getting in on that?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, yes, there are a group. There's 34,000 that are untapped that we have to reach out and bring back into the, get into the system of that 73,000.
And follow up? And of those 34,000, how many of those might be eligible to be in one of these programs, and how much might that mean on an annual basis coming into the state, into our economy?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, the amount, I can't give you an amount. However, the reasons are there's many reasons why many don't come in. It's either lack of knowledge. You'll find in our ICER survey that we just did, you'll find that in the paper today. It's regarding benefits, some with the lack of knowledge of the benefits. Hence, we are trying to get out there into the communities to reach out and grab those people. It could be also a language barrier. UPIC is one that's very difficult when it comes to language barrier for our service officers, so we reach out to our tribal veterans representatives to help us out. And again, with that language barrier, it could take some time.
And this is a follow-up comment, being that about two-thirds of the veterans are in the program, that's bringing $56 million. We brought in another 34, that could mean another 20, 30 million maybe into the state.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Beth. I represent you. Great.
Please go ahead.
This year, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs sent over $244 million for disability compensation and pension payments to veterans and their families who reside in Alaska. If we had that 73,000 that were actually recognized in our VA healthcare system, we could reduce the strain on our healthcare systems, especially under the Affordable Care Act, meet the minimum essential care rules. Our veteran service officers, we have a budget of $2.8 million just in the Office of Veterans Affairs, and right off the top, we take $1,015,700 and transfer that to our veterans organizations grant program. And that's where we get our 17 service officers from. The return on investment, as I mentioned earlier, was a $56 million from $1,015,700. The five organizations that we recognize through this grant is the American Legion, the Disabled American Veterans, Military Order of the Purple Heart, Veterans of Foreign War, and the Vietnam Veterans of America. All 17 service officers are accredited and trained, highly trained, locally and nationally. They receive this grant from us as an agreement that we require them to travel to two highly rural areas once a month, at least two, minimum. Recently, our Disabled American Veterans took it upon themselves to contact their national headquarters and requested $17,000 in the form of checks. And we were able to partner with the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management regarding the Card Fire, the Card Street Fire, and the Sockeye Fire, and send a service officer there. And they were able to reach out to veterans and write checks right on the spot, so that way the payments were made immediate. So this was something new and dynamic, and some of the service organizations in the lower 48 saw this, and they're looking at doing the same thing. So this is something that we just started, and again, it was a partnership with the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. And we anticipate doing this from now on. The states, because we're a model with the other states regarding our service officers, the state of Washington State has removed all of their county service officers, rehired their new service officers under service organizations because of our grant program. Because it's working. The counties, most states have county service officers. And those county service officers, there are usually people who jump into those spots as a stepping stone into a state position. So their heart is technically not in it when it comes to our veterans in some of the states. Hence why we get a lot of calls up here in Alaska from other veterans. And why Washington State has turned over their program to look model ours. The state of Virginia, the legislators have been contacting us recently wanting to do the same thing. our highly rural travel grant that I spoke about a few minutes ago. This year, we were awarded the VA's highly rural travel transportation grant. It competes on a national level, and we received the largest amount awarded issued to any state of $250,000. 26 states are eligible for this program. Our goal, when we had the MOU with the Veterans Affairs, was to reach out to 8,200 veterans in highly rural areas. The program started 1 September of last year. We weren't able to get it off the ground because of the funding transfer until January of this year. We were able to reach out from January to September of this year, 5,901 veterans in highly rural areas. The stringent guidelines for the five boroughs that we selected for this grant, each one received $50,000. The recipients that we selected was the Alaska Marine Highway for Kodiak Island, the Interior Alaska Bus Line, Denali, which is south of Fairbanks, Interior Island Ferry System, Prince of Wales, Hyder, Valley Movers in the Matanuska Sitna Valley, and AAA Alaska Cabin, the Kenai Peninsula. Ground transportation for three of the recipients combined was over 220,000 miles. Nautical miles for the ferry system and both ferry systems, was over 67,000 nautical miles, transporting our veterans between January and September. We requested another $250,000 grant this year, and we look forward to using this grant continually. Our stand-downs. Military has stand-downs. Military people understand what a stand-down is when we do a stand-down. It's when we have something that needs to be addressed in that unit, or there's a safety violation or something occurs. The VA does the same thing on the outside. It's an annual program providing veterans in a need for a hand-up with various types of direct assistance regarding medical, dental screenings, housing assistance, employment assistance, financial assistance, and, of course, legal assistance. Due to the successes in the past here in Alaska with the off-road system, we requested additional funding from the VA's Office of Rural Health to support this effort, and we used extra funds for Unalaska, Homer, Soldotna, Kotzebue, and Nome. Although these events added additional workload for our staff as well as local VA outreach teams, it was worth the effort, and each community was well served through this program. We were able to reach and serve over 2,500 veterans at our annual Anchorage and Fairbanks events. These events are critical because they bring local key providers together under one roof. Our tribal veterans representatives that I spoke about is a continued partnership with the VA to train tribal veterans representatives as key and critical to the success of reaching out to every veteran in the village. An additional 50 volunteers this year were trained through the classes held before our rural stand-downs. We have over 250 trained tribal veterans representatives, hence why we needed the language barrier brought closer, actually knocked down. This is the largest veterans volunteer corps in the nation under this model. Other states that use the Tribal Veterans Representative Program is Washington State, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Utah, California, and Nevada. Since this program's inception in 2011, veterans and their families have friendly boots on the ground in their communities across Alaska. The TVRs support our ability to reach those veterans who would never venture out of their homes for assistance. Our service officers are tied to our TVRs here. Our service officers communicate with our TVRs before they enter the area to make sure that the TVR can get the service officer to whom they need to get to. That's why it's important to have our TVR communication gap closed. The Alaska Territorial Guard. We continue our agreements with the Department of Defense, finding, researching, and issuing discharges to our Alaska Territorial Guard. Our efforts are much more difficult due to fewer family members requesting discharges. Also, communities in the past would identify those who have served today. Most ATG veterans were either passed away with no family left in the community, or they served in, or they moved themselves to a larger community. Our goal is to ensure that every Alaska Territorial Guard veteran who has served has a discharge document on file. As research continues, living ATG members are still being found today. This year, we personally presented discharges with the assistance of our Adjutant General. We gave discharge to Sergeant Nick Abalama out of Egagic and Private Adronic Kashivarov from St. George Island. We have completed an authoritative list of those who've served in the Alaska Territorial Guard, for this list is located on our webpage and also in our benefits booklet. This list also allows the U.S. Army the ability to expedite and submit discharge documents. In 2015, there were 210 records reviewed and 110 discharges authenticated by the Department of Defense. Over 90% of the records reviewed are accomplished today without requests from family members because we're able to get them, capture them off of the other websites or other venues. While the goal is lofty, our focus is now correcting those that were previously oversight in 1947 for us, the Territorial Guard.
Of course, question, Representative Ledoux?
Okay. So I just want to clarify, the Territorial Guard members receive the exact same veterans benefits that regular Army, Navy, Air Force, et cetera, do. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that is correct. That is why we want to make sure every Alaska Territorial Guard has a discharge document. Because then that makes them eligible for VA benefits.
Yes, go ahead.
Follow up. And this may be as much for Commissioner Dole as for you. We have a sizable group in this state of Hmong people who worked for, who served this country during the Vietnam War. My understanding is that they get no veterans benefits at all, and I'm just wondering what, if anything, is happening in Washington, D.C. right now to get them into that system, because they were great fighters for us during the Vietnam War, and my understanding is they get no benefits. Is my understanding correct? And if it is, what can we do about that?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, you are correct. As you know, Senator Murkowski at the end of last session introduced a request that would have at least allowed the Hmong that served in support of U.S. forces during the conflict in Southeast Asia to be buried in VA cemeteries. With the end of the last session, that bill also ended and was not passed. At this point, they are not the Hmong who served side by side and many times went and rescued our service members who were downed airmen, sometimes suffering 10 casualties for every American they rescued. Passerly, I think we both know, comes to mind in that regard. They received no benefits. There is ongoing discussion in Washington, D.C. At this point, there are no bills pending that would extend that recognition. If this committee is so inclined, they can certainly contact our congressional delegation, and that is one of the things that Commissioner Hummel and I have spoken of, too, in terms of the most effective way to provide appropriate recognition for these forces. Just as the Filipino forces provided invaluable assistance to the United States forces in World War II, and we belatedly found means of recognition, there is a debt that's still unpaid to that group.
Is there a debt still unpaid to the Filipinos also? I thought they were covered, a generation or two later.
They were a generation or two later. I believe we have paid that debt, but the Hmong you're speaking
right.
who stepped in harm's way for our U.S. service members, there are no benefits and scant recognition to them as we sit here today.
What's the hold up? I mean, is it totally monetary or why?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I won't pretend to understand Washington, D.C. I only lived there 7 years, and it was a mystery to me from the small part I see of it. I think there is a variety of concerns, money and being part of it, too, that they did not swear an oath of allegiance like somebody does when they enlist in our armed forces in terms of doctrinal bases and other things. I honestly don't understand myself how Washington works in general and specifically on this point why we have not addressed this differently.
Thank you.
Representative Lynn, you have a question?
Yes, thank you. I think we owe a lot to our Hmong colleagues in Vietnam. I'm a Vietnam veteran, as you know. Also, the Moton Yards, now most of the Moton Yards are in either North or South Carolina, I forget which. But would perhaps a resolution, either individually or from the committee here, supporting some help for the Hmong, Moton Yards, and others who fought beside us side by side, could that be helpful to our congressional delegation or whoever else?
Through the chair, it certainly would not hurt that we, we cannot forget those who did this, and I think it certainly would not hurt to show that this issue is still alive and well and needs to be addressed. And we could even look forward to what we are, those that served with us in Afghanistan and some of the issues, some of the translators and others from this conflict are facing too in terms of assistance as they seek immigration to the U.S. and things like that. So I think legislative action on this as a resolution would certainly help.
Thank you.
Yeah, one more question, Mary?
Just one more question. I have heard from some of my Hmong constituents that the military doesn't permit military representatives to appear at their Hmong Day recognition ceremonies. Do you know whether that's correct, my information is correct or not?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we will certainly look into that. I know we have sent, from the National Guard side, we have sent representatives to every event to which we've been invited. And we will look into that and get back to you in terms of trying to figure out what's going on there.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So, Forrest, if you could conclude so we can ask the next person to come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Alaska Frontier Honor Flight. World War II and Korea veterans are given the opportunity to visit their war monuments in Washington, D.C. with an escort. We challenged nonprofit organizations and corporations 2 years ago to help the Honor Flight program flourish. And with our support, they ensure that the Alaska Territorial Guard members had the opportunity to attend this also. We attend every Welcome Home event at Ted Stevens Airport. And what I wish to share with you today is that we cordially invite you to greet 23 World War II and Korean War veterans who will be arriving on this Saturday, October 17th at Ted Stevens Airport at 11:30. There will be one ATG member who will be escorted by his family member. I relinquish the mic to the chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, we have a couple questions first.
Actually, that veteran service booklet that you have, is that something we could each have in our offices? I just think it would be a resource for us if they might be available.
Now, through the chair, Representative Hughes, we have a handful of books for you after we're done here.
President Colvin?
Through the chair, you said you had 17 veteran service officers. Where are they located, and is that an increase from the past? It seems like you've done a good job getting more veteran service officers out there to help folks.
Through the chair, Representative Colvert, our 17 service officers are located. We have 8 located in Anchorage. We have 3 located in Fairbanks. We have 1 located in Kenai, 1 located let me write this down, please.
we just put one in Ketchikan. That's in the last couple months while
Correct.
He's catching up.
Correct.
There.
Correct. Ketchikan and the valley here. Yep, the valley. We got 2 in the valley. 3 in the valley. If I could put my bill through the chair, if I'd be able to repeat it. We have 8 in Anchorage. We have 1 in Ketchikan, 1 in Kenai, 3 in Fairbanks, and 2 in the Matsu Valley.
Okay, just to follow up, Mr. Chair. So that's a lot more than we've had in the past as we've gradually been able to fund and add more veteran service officers, over the last 10, 15 years, to your knowledge.
Through the chair, Representative Culver, we've added two service officers 2 years ago. That was when we went from 15 to 17. And that was the last time we've added any service officers.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have a...
Yes, sir. Representative Hughes.
Just a closing comment. Understanding the budget challenges that face us and what might be happening here in the state, I would hope that you're having discussions and even hope more so that you have plans to try to more assertively connect with the 34,000 veterans who you are not yet reaching. And so I just leave you with that comment.
To the Chair, Representative Hughes, thank you.
Mr.
Chairman, representatives, good morning. I'm Colonel Joe Streff. I am the commander of the Alaska Army National Guard. I'm joined today with Major Michelle Edwards, the Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel. We'd like to discuss a little bit about the Army Guard and how we operate in Alaska. We have a vision, which is a diverse and trusted and capable organization ready to conduct unified land operations for the federal government and the state of Alaska. Our mission is to maintain ready units and soldiers that are available to support the governor and fellow Alaskans for domestic operations, while also ready to deploy worldwide in support of the national military strategy. We have four lines of effort, which are the things that we focus on, and everything we do is in support of these lines of effort. The first one is to provide a relevant and ready and available force. This ensures mission readiness, again, for both federal and state government. Now, the second one is to continually improve Alaska National Guard professionalism. This involves a spectrum of soldiering, to include being experts in occupational skills, to living the Army values, and growing our leadership skills. Third is subject matter experts in the Arctic domain. This is an emergent issue for us, and we look forward to working with our federal and state partners on this issue. And then partnered and aligned with appropriate agencies. From the federal perspective, this includes the major headquarters in Alaska, such as ALCOM, North America, which is NORTHCOM, and then Pacific. Ensuring that we are ready to serve in those regions. Within the state of Alaska, we work with Department of Emergency Services, Department of Forestry, local emergency management agencies, and local responders to prepare for a disaster. Our force structure includes two brigades, the 297th Battlefield Surveillance Brigade and the 38th Troop Command. We also have a joint forces headquarters with a total of 1,850 soldiers. Within the brigades, there are battalions. Those battalions include an aviation battalion with 20 Black Hawk helicopters, a reconnaissance and surveillance battalion, and then a military police headquarters. There are a number of smaller units which serve as enablers, such as engineers, signal, transportation, and maintenance. Our force structure will undergo significant conversions this year, changing the 297th Battlefield Surveillance Brigade to a regional support group and the reconnaissance and surveillance unit to an infantry battalion. Support understand that the Guard operates in different statuses by U.S. Code, United States Code. While in Alaska, the Guardsmen are titled 32 status, and as such, our chain of command includes the Adjutant General and the Governor. When we deploy, we convert to Title 10 and fall under the command of active duty authorities and the President. And in our organization, we train to both federal and state missions. As a National Guard, we are funded by the Department of Defense and the National Guard Bureau to train to accomplish our federal mission. The formations within the Guard are purposed to participate in the warfight. We do not receive federal funding to train to conduct our state mission. Our key federal missions include wartime readiness for our units to include mobilizing, deploying, and operating in a theater of war in accordance with our prescribed missions,
but we also support the Ground Missile Defense Mission at Fort Greely. We are on watch 24/7, 365, operating as the nation's defenders against an intercontinental ballistic missile attack. Michelle?
Good morning, Chairman, Representative. As stated earlier, I'm Major Michelle Edwards, the Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel for the Army Guard. I'm going to cover our state mission. We provide emergency response. We prepare for and respond to requests by all civil authorities for support ranging from flood relief, search and rescue missions, emergency housing for citizens in our armories, snow removal, and earthquakes. We conduct firefighting, as you know. This summer, we supported 131 hours, the Mat-Su and the Kenai fires. We have a civil support team, which comprises of 22 specially trained Army and Air Guardsmen to assist civil authorities in the case of a chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and explosive events. We stand ready to provide non-emergency assistance to local and federal authorities. For example, in the support of Glacier Summit, we provided military police support to the Anchorage Police Department and the state troopers, aviation support to the U.S. Secret Service, and refueling support to Marine One. We also assist communities with military capabilities through the innovative readiness program. The Guard has helped deliver medical care, build infrastructure, and supply veterinary care throughout the state. The innovative readiness program combines the efforts and skills of all the branches of the armed forces to train in their career fields while benefiting citizens throughout the United States. Alaska provides a challenging environment for the program and offers a number of unique training opportunities for the military. Another fascinating mission of ours is our state partnership program. Alaska is partnered with Mongolia. The program links the National Guard with armed forces of a partner country in a cooperative, mutually beneficial relationship. This program is administered by the National Guard Bureau and is guided by State Department foreign policy goals. It is executed by the Adjutant General in support of Combatant Commander and U.S. Chief of Mission Security Cooperation Objectives and the Department of Defense policy goals. The National Guard conducts military-to-military engagement and also leverages relationships and capabilities to facilitate broader interagency and corollary engagement spanning military, government, economic, educational, and social spheres. There's a number of challenges and opportunities we face in the Army Guard. As the Army draws down, the standards for recruits have gone up. This creates challenges in Alaska and for those who might consider serving in the armed forces. As such, 70% of the recruit population ages 18 to 25 does not qualify to join the military, and that's a national statistic. This is further exacerbated in Alaska with some of the challenges that our youth face. We are working with the Alaska State Defense Force to afford as many Alaskans the opportunity to serve our great state. We also face a reduction of federal and state funds, which is causing us to assess our stationing plan and subsequently where we can afford to have our armories. In the past, we've had up to 80 armories across the state. With the changes that we face, we're reducing our footprint to 18 locations. The benefit to Alaska is the other armories that we aren't able to use have been and will continue to be repurposed throughout the state. In conclusion, the Alaska Army National Guard is filled with highly trained and motivated soldiers who volunteer to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States and the state of Alaska. We are united in our resolve to be a diverse, trusted, and capable organization ready to accomplish the mission set before us. We hold true to the Army values and uphold the laws of the state, the nation, and the military. Thank you for the opportunity to share our story with you today.
Colonel and Major, a couple of questions. The committee would like, Representative Culver represents Fort Greely. The committee would, in the future sometime, we'd like to get a tour of Fort Greely if that's possible.
Mr. Chairman, I think we can accommodate that. We have a number of opportunities throughout the year that we can coordinate for you.
Okay, please work with Representative Culver and so we can, that timing of it, you know, obviously we're going to special sessions, so it ain't going to happen anytime soon, but another question is when, the President of the United States was here, how was that, I'm just out of curiosity, how was, well, we get VIPs that come in for all the time, but could you just explain how much higher intensity of that trip was compared to other VIPs that come to Alaska that you're associated with?
In terms of, are you talking about a security event or?
No, just because it was the President of the United States. I mean, was it super intense compared to other VIPs or was?
I would say it was probably as intense as it gets.
Okay. That's all. That annoying details. Then one farther, this is probably to the major, is, you know, you talk about how the standards have gone up for recruits. Is barrier crimes, I mean, when a kid that's 16 makes a stupid mistake, are barrier crimes part of that issue facing all of us?
Well, Chairman, it depends on what that individual is charged with and what it states on the record.
Yeah, but, Major, I guess it's a societal question is, should we have, you know, because right now the state of Alaska, we want to release a lot of prisoners because we can't afford to keep them all because they have relatively minor crimes. And then, of course, the federal government's doing the same thing. So I guess it's really not a question for you to answer, but just a statement, is this something that we have to reconsider so that people that make silly mistakes when they're underage and that prevents them from maturing and then getting into the military, is that's probably where I would, just more of a comment rather than a question to you.
Yes, Chairman. There's some offenses that are waiverable, most certainly. Some of the domestic violence offenses are not waiverable, but a lot of the other offenses may be.
Representative Culver and then Representative Ledoux.
Okay, through the chair, so I just appreciate the focus here, then, the chairman, on the missile defense mission of the Guard at Fort Greely. How can the legislature help support, liaison, communicate, you know, any of the needs there, housing, staffing, recruitment, equipment, facilities? When I toured it, I was we were told that your personnel, when they first started up, they didn't even have protection in the gun turret when they're cruising in the missile field. If, you know, and there's quite a bit of rotation required because it's 40 below with wind. It's very windy there. But you do have a good long-term force there because of the recruitment efforts. In, for instance, in Puerto Rico, it's a good, I think, a bump in pay and a long-term commitment. So just curious as how we can help communicate through our channels and help support the Guard's mission there. I realize there's a lot of different commands interlinking at that facility, and that might be difficult to work through the chain of command to get your issues highlighted sometimes.
Sure. Through the chair, Mr. Culver, I'd say I appreciate the offer. This is an evolutionary issue. As you know, this mission started in 2004, and there's been an increase in both the equipment readiness and then the personnel posture. I would say that we are 100% capable of accomplishing this mission. I will go ahead and bring this to the commander, both of the 49th Missile Battalion and the 100th Missile Brigade down in Colorado, and ask them that question.
Thank you.
This is a little bit of a follow-up on Karen's question. You mentioned that about 25% of Alaska youth are not eligible to be in the National Guard because of the standards of the Guard. Is that correct?
Through the chairman, yes, ma'am. It's actually 30%, and that's a national statistic. So the office looks nationally, ages 18 to 25, who is eligible to join the military. And they even further look into the people who are propensed or likely to join the military. So that's not Alaska-specific, but that's nationally.
So other than the barrier crimes, which Chair Herron referred to, what are the things that keep people out of joining the Army? I mean, 30% seems like a relatively high figure. So I guess I'm trying to figure out what exactly are the standards that people aren't meeting.
Through the Chairman, Representative Ledoux, Some of the standards are education requirements. The battery test is required for everyone who joins the military, and it's not just Alaska National Guard standards, it's Army standards. We in the Alaska Army National Guard have to meet all regular Army standards. And a lot of it's education requirements. There's some of the legal requirements as well. And all of those individuals are people who actually want to join the military as well.
So, is there any written, I mean, I guess I'm just trying to figure out what exactly are these standards? I mean, when you say tests, for example, the battery of tests, do you have to get a certain percentage on the tests, or what exactly is it we're talking about?
Through the chairman, yes, ma'am. For each different job in the Army, there's different scores that are required. And I can get you more specific details on what the basic requirements are and then what the in-depth requirements are for specific jobs in addition to moving up in higher ranks and becoming an officer, if you would like that information.
I actually would like that information. And is a high school graduation diploma, is that required, or will a GED do the trick, or...
Through the chairman, yes, ma'am, a GED does qualify.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Permission to supplement, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
We recognize as an administration the federal standards aren't necessarily the best fit to Alaska. In that regard, Governor Walker has sent a letter to President Obama that's military-specific on ideas to increase the opportunities and allow better participation across Alaska and the National Guard. Also in that regard... General Hummel has invited, and Lieutenant General Kadavi, thank you. The commander of director of the Army National Guard nationwide will be visiting Alaska in a few months to see why these voluminous federal requirements for enlistment don't necessarily make sense in Alaska, and why it shortchanges us on folks who are fantastic kinetic learners who can figure out and look at an engine, figure out how to tear it down, put back together, or shoot a weapon. Why maybe filling out a written test on how to tear down an engine isn't the best way to capture what these Americans can do for this great nation. So we've taken the initiative on that, as has Governor Walker, to make sure that we're doing what makes sense for Alaska and America.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Lynn.
I just want to make sure that... none of the standards are lowered. It's a very significant thing to be in the military, either regular military or one of the guard units. We cannot let our standards down. Responsibilities are too high, always have been, always will be. So we have to be very careful about lowering standards. That's a no-no to me.
Thank you. Please, go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Colonel Karen Mansfield. I'm Commander of the Alaska Air National Guard, and I've realized the benefit of following my Army brethren in that he defined some terms for you that I won't redefine for you. When I talk about federal, I am talking about our guardsmen executing in Title 10 status and any non-federal status, or the executing in Title 32 status, as he mentioned. The vision for the Alaska Air Guard is to be a community-based force that exceeds all standards with the most diverse, relevant, and resilient Air Guard units in the nation. We have four key efforts, which include to preserve capability and capacity by optimizing total force initiatives, to ensure resourcing to meet operational needs, champion force development opportunities to shape our leaders, and probably of most importance to the panel is to expand our unique dual-use capability in support of state, community, and partners. I want to explain the Air Guard missions to you, and I'll do that by location and wing, but first... for those of you unfamiliar, a wing is the standard organizational structure, and I know some of you are familiar, but for those that aren't, the air component, both for active duty and reserve. Within a wing, there are standard groups, one for operations, whether you're a flying mission, a cyber mission, an intel mission, one for maintenance, one for medical, and one for support. I'm doing a little bit of a deep dive here to help you understand that within the groups, there are also squadrons. So, for example, in each of our two wings, we have a mission support group that would have a comm squadron, communication squadron, a civil engineering squadron, a logistics readiness squadron, a security forces squadron, and a personnel support squadron. And in each of those unique units, there are unique technical and specialty capabilities that we can leverage for our dual-use state and community needs in emergency or states, state response support. The wings and their units exist to support the federal mission, yes, but while training for those missions, your guardsmen fall under command of the Adjutant General, General Hummel, and the Governor. However, I want to make it clear that in your Alaska Air National Guard, we're doing some of those federal missions right now, in place, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And for others, we are only federalized when we deploy out of state. Due to those in-place federal missions, Alaska's Air Guard units have more full-time personnel than most others. Approximately 40% of our 2,400-person force are full-time. And we are more operationally engaged than many Guard units. As a matter of fact, the current Third Wing Active Duty Air Force commander likes to joke that our Guard Wing is more operationally engaged on a day-to-day business than his Active Duty Wing is. There are two Air Guard wings in the Alaska Air Guard. Starting up north in Fairbanks, the 168th is an air refueling wing, has about 820 members, located as a tenant on Eielson Air Force Base. The 168th has guard-owned aircraft, so we have eight KC-135 Stratotankers, which are a modified Boeing 707 to provide fuel, and 16 crews in the operations group with associated maintenance group, mission support group, and medical group, as I mentioned. Additionally, we are in the process of renaming that wing from Air Refueling to Simply Wing due to the transition of the 213th Space Warning Squadron at Clear Air Station, which is in Anderson, about two-hour drive south of Fairbanks. Alaskan Guardsmen now comprise the operations crew at Clear Air Station. They are providing the manning for continuous space surveillance, watching the space for missiles targeting all of North America in a federal status. The tanker mission also supports that same 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week, or 7 days a week, 365-day-a-year federal requirement when its members sit alert, waiting to launch or provide fuel for the active-duty fighters that are scrambled to meet inbound, unidentified aircraft or known, usually Russian, threats that are coming into our area of responsibility. Additionally, well, most importantly, what I want you to know is we have the busiest tanker unit in the Air National Guard, hands down. Between supporting that alert, the active duty flying in the training ranges, multiple exercises, they're also deploying next summer to meet their Air Expeditionary Force requirement over into CENTCOM. They've also recently added a new mission and personnel to the Civil Engineering Squadron, that of Prime B for Prime Base Engineering Emergency Force, which will add skilled engineers capable of building or repairing infrastructure in wartime or an emergency environment. Once activated, it's a perfect mission set for our key effort of expanding dual-use capability for emergency response within the state and providing potential support to rural communities in need. That's the wing up north. Down south, in Anchorage, as a tenant on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, we have our second wing, which is the 176th Wing. With an authorized manning strength of 1,500, this is the larger wing and is comprised of five mission sets. And I'll tell you straight out, that's unusual for one wing to have five operational mission sets. Usually a wing is just one, so it's a very complicated, multifaceted wing. The most historical and parent unit is the 144th Airlift Squadron, which has eight C-130 Hercules. That's the Lockheed four-engine turboprop that you've probably seen flying overhead quite a bit. Cargo aircraft and 16 crews assigned. The C-130's tactical range and short runway operations ability make it the optimal choice for the Alaskan area of responsibility, which is why it's been the workhorse for Operation Santa Claus for so many years. Our C-130 squadron is also scheduled to deploy next year overseas again for CENTCOM to fill their Air Expeditionary Force tasking. Within that same wing, we have the 249th Airlift Squadron, which is a classic association with the active duty. This falls firmly in line with one of our key efforts, continue and grow upon total force initiatives. Because an active classic association means we provide crews and maintenance components to fly and fix aircraft that are owned by the active duty, who is concurrently flying and maintaining that same aircraft. But they own the iron. The C-17 Globemaster is a large military transport aircraft that provides strategic lift capability to the DOD while it's still able to land in approximately 40 runways within the state of Alaska, so it can be called upon for emergency response within the state if needed. The remaining flying units within the wing are the 210th Rescue Squadron, which provides five rescue helicopters to carry the members of the 212th Rescue Squadron, which are the pararescue men that make up the Guardian Angel weapon system, and the 211th Rescue Squadron, which is the 8C-130's refueling aircraft, that same four-engine turboprop, but modified to be a tanker, The rescue team provides continuous alert for the federal resources flying in Alaska and concurrently can then provide civil search and rescue as needed. Our refuelers and helos provide the only long-range airborne search and rescue capability for the state of Alaska and for the waters surrounding it. While the Coast Guard has responsibility for overwater rescues, without air refueling capability, they are limited in their long-range response, and that's often when the Air Guard gets called in. Of all of the ongoing missions supported by the Air Guard, you are likely most familiar with the rescue. If someone needs an off-road system, high altitude, requires a hoist and medical care, the Alaska Air Guard is requested by civil authorities. And we are called to respond by the Air Guard members manning the Rescue Coordination Center on J-Bear, which is another one of our, you're going to get tired of hearing it, I know, 24/7, 365 days a year missions, which is owned by the Alaska Air National Guard. The Rescue Coordination Center coordinates all federal and civil SAR for the state, working with civil authorities, the Coast Guard, and troopers to determine the best available responders. Because of the nature of Alaska, the 210th, 11th, and 12th are often requested to pull the hiker from the glacier, the kayaker from the water, and the downed airman from the crash site. Last year alone, the RCC requested Air National Guard support 40 times, and 49 saves were awarded. Since the Air National Guard took over the Rescue Coordination Center mission in 1994, they've run over 5,000 missions with 2,223 saves within the state of Alaska. The last and final non-flying mission for the 176th Wing is the Air Defense Squadron, located on J-Bear as well. It's the Airspace Warning and Surveillance Squadron, and our guardsmen are watching the skies again all day, all night, every day of the year, providing control as we intercept the increasing number of Russian aircraft approaching our airspace. So if there's an unknown or hostile aircraft, it's the Alaska Air Guard that detects the track, directs the launch of the fighter, controls the intercept, refuels the fighter, and if unfortunately need be, rescues the airmen if they need to be rescued. All that occurs while the wings continue to support their overseas deployment requirements. For example, the 176th Civil Engineering Squadron and Security Force Squadrons right now are currently deployed. So while rescue illustrates it best, the beauty of these federal missions is they give us well-trained, specialized personnel and specialized equipment to meet state needs. Through programs like Arctic Care, Veteran Stand Down, and Missions of Mercy, our medical troops provide care for both urban and rural patients. Our airlift and mission support squadrons provided transportation and food service for the rural move of Nutak to Mtarvik. For Operation Deep Dig in Cordova, we deployed Air Guard personnel, along with our Army Guard brethren to clear roofs during a local disaster caused by the heavy snowfall. So I hope I've conveyed to you that your Alaska Air National Guard is actively, operationally engaged right now, today, executing and training to both in-place and deployed missions vital to the nation while providing well-trained personnel and capabilities for the state and communities. Mr. Chairman, I do believe I've also provided a fact sheet that has some budgetary information and personnel information within your package. Mr. Chairman, any questions?
Colonel, you said that it's really unusual for a wing to have so many responsibilities. Obviously, Alaska is different. And Alaskans, and I know I am, I'm very proud of the Army and Air Guard of Alaska. But why isn't there another wing elsewhere that has as much responsibility as our wing?
Well, what drives us having the mission is the federal requirement. So we're a PACAF gained, Alaska's PACAF gained. And so within the PACAF operation orders and conceptual plans, for the threat in the PACAF arena, they derive what mission requirements they need. And that, in there, they define that because of the strategic location of Alaska, these mission sets are required here. So you need your strategic lift, your tactical lift, your rescue here for the Pacific arena, where you wouldn't want it in the middle of Iowa, if that makes sense. Sir.
I just wanted it for the record. I mean, Billy Mitchell recognized it many, many years ago, and I'm glad we still do as well. And so one final question before I go to other committee members. Is the Russian, are testing us, percentage-wise, is it 50% more than it was 5 years ago, or can you even state that?
Sir, I would say it's on a gradual and continual increase probably over the last 5 to 6 years. I can't really give you a percentage. I can tell you that's actually my background, but I've been out of it for a few years. But I can tell you that the Air Defense Squadron and the fighters are scrambling exponentially more than they have in the past. And you're right, it is a, you know, kind of on a testing and training schedule concurrent with the Russian buildup of capability.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering whether in the search and rescue efforts the Air Guard has plans to use an unmanned aircraft system so you can send one up when the weather isn't safe to send a manned aircraft.
Through the Chair. Representative Hughes, there's nothing like that on the horizon right now for the Air Guard. The rescue forces are owned by Air Force Rescue Command, so I could look into it and see if there's any initiatives there for you and get back, but nothing on the horizon for the Air Guard.
Thank you.
All right. The Colonel talked about your two bases. Any questions you have to ask of her?
If I could just make a statement, there is a tremendous amount of activity, at least we hope, in the very near future at Eielson Air Force Base with the bringing in the F-35s, which I think all we're kind of waiting for at this point, hopefully, is to get through the process and get a signature and the ink will dry, which is going to... And will that expand the Air Guard's mission as well there?
Through the Chair, Representative, I know that there's probably initiatives out there, but they're at a much higher level at this point in terms of the total force continuum and total force initiatives. I can say generically that the way ahead for the active duty right now is that with almost any new mission set, they're looking for ways to build associations. Whether or not that'll happen here within Alaska is not yet determined.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, as the committee tours and goes to Fort Greeley, I'll just say that if you do get an opportunity, go to the coolest facility in the Western Hemisphere, which is Clear. That is, I'd always heard about the Star Wars things, and in a previous life as a municipal official, when I got to go to Clear, that was absolutely phenomenal. It gives me a lot of confidence and a lot of pride just to be an American to have that type of technology, and what actually happens at Clear is just phenomenal to me.
So, Colonel, this committee, the makeup of this committee, will have one more year's worth of life before the next election. So maybe within a year we could get a tour of Clear as well.
Mr. Chairman, I think we can make that happen.
Thank you.
Chairman, I was going to provide this is Bob Dolligan, I was going to provide a brief update on the enabling legislation for an update Alaska Code of Military Justice.
Please, go ahead.
And basically, you're looking at the summary there. Lieutenant Forrest Dunbar is still working on this on our behalf. He is outside on a prearranged appointment today, so I'm filling in for him on there. As you know, this committee passed this bill out of committee in April of 2015, where it was passed to the Judiciary Committee, where Representative Ledoux is chair. So a little bit intimidating trying to brief the chairman on her own bill. But I think there, as we look at it, we see four significant changes that are happening or on the horizon. The first one is the punitive article, that is saying what conduct is sanctionable is now being done by statute instead of regulations. That will strengthen the separation of powers between the legislative and executive branch, and it'll provide you all with better checks and balances to keep us in check. The next point was kind of a demand signal when we went back to our audience with this, and that was specifically the junior enlisted and junior officers were adamant that there are some offenses that even if a civilian court could prosecute them, if a civilian prosecutor says, no, I don't want to deal with it for whatever reason, and we think we could still effectively prosecute the individual, they want to be able to press on sexual assaults and DUIs. The military is a collective effort. I, as a soldier in a foxhole, have to trust this soldier over here to do his side of the deal. I, as a pilot, have to trust my co-pilot to handle his side of the cockpit. And the overwhelming concern from these groups was they want to be able to have full faith and confidence in the person that they're doing this mission with. The next area is scope of coverage of the Alaska Code of Military Justice, and for a guardsman, a traditional guardsman who is not a full-time member of the military, for an Alaska Code of Military Justice to carry out what is intended for, it needs to be effective 24/7. Even when you're not on the base in uniform, you can still do serious damage to the good order and discipline of the organization. We need a mechanism to recognize that. Finally, we envision in the next Judiciary Committee hearing in the forthcoming amendments the maximum punishments for the various offenses to be fixed. We have not been, and to save you notes, we prepared the summary here so you didn't have to frantically scribble while I was talking. We are not sitting by as the process works in the legislature. We have been what we call red teaming or test driving these provisions in terms of seeing if they do what they're intended to do. Major Elmore can provide more details if needed, but basically we've gone through two scenarios with these, or two different iterations where we've brought in military lawyers from both sides to basically poke holes in the process and make sure it carries out the intended purpose. And so far, all systems are go. I stand ready for your questions, Mr. Chairman. And
well, I appreciate the different summaries here. And I think that this is just a comment, not a question, and no response is required, but just from when I was staffing many years ago in the legislature, we had the military budget, and what I've seen, of course, I'm a veteran, but what I had seen, this is just purely a comment, is that there was sort of this the Army and the Alaska National Guard, both sides, were sort of left alone. The governors really didn't know what to do with it. The legislature said, just go take care of it. And so I really appreciate the bullet number three, is that military jurisdiction is 24/7. I really appreciate it. And Representative Ledoux?
Yes, I just have two comments to make, Commissioner Dahl. First of all, Lieutenant Dunbar has been an absolute delight to work with. And I anticipate getting this bill heard. Of course, we can't pass it out of committee. But having this bill heard the next time when we are in Juneau during our special session, so that all systems will be go before we start the regular session in January. But the second comment I wanted to make is, while this bill, I think, is a really good bill in order to give the leadership of the National Guard tools in the tool chest to work with, those tools in the tool chest only work when we are talking about excellent leadership in the Guard. And one thing that I'm a little bit concerned about is that this bill will be passed, we'll all congratulate ourselves, and then we'll go back to work. And while I certainly believe right now that we've got the right leadership in the Guard, we're also talking to Guard members about some of the things that we might be able to do just in case there ever is a scenario where the leadership on top is not what it's supposed to be. Because you actually make rules for when things go wrong, not when everything is going right. So I just wanted to apprise you of that, and we look forward to working with you on perhaps a subsequent bill.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Ledoux. And we have, speaking for Lieutenant Dunbar, General Hummel, we working with the Judiciary Committee and moving this forward has been very rewarding and appreciated by us and the legislature's support of this important effort. I can assure you from the top down, Governor Walker is commander-in-chief. The last two times he's been out on base has been meeting with soldiers and airmen directly He doesn't just want to hear from us what's going on or his chief of staff. He asks them direct, boots on the ground, what's going on. General Hummel was out and about, too. And there's a commitment to full, engaged leadership addressing those things and making the hard calls. I'll also add that after some of those visits, we get asked the tough questions, too, from my boss's boss to make sure we're doing right by our service members and by Alaska.
Thank you. Appreciate that and appreciate your service.
All right. Thank you. Seeing no other questions, we can move on to the next.
Well, I'll be joined by Brigadier General Alaska Hull of the Alaska State Defense Force.
Mr. Chair, I'm Brigadier General Roger Hull, Commander of the Alaska State Defense Force. I also have with me today Lieutenant Colonel John James, who is the Dancer, who is our Director of Training and Operations. And it is my pleasure today to speak on behalf of the volunteer men and women who serve in the Alaska State Defense Force. Today I want to inform you of the mission, the structure, accomplishments, the rural engagement, and the future plans of the State Defense Force, with concluding my remarks with several new changes that we're making. First of all, the Alaska State Defense Force does have a vision, an Arctic strategy to expand throughout the state of Alaska. We believe that we need to expand our engagement as well. Now, sometimes the Alaska State Defense Force is not too well known among the public, so I'd like to sort of define who we are and what we do. And that's first defined by the mission. And the mission of the State Defense Force is to train and equip an adequately organized military reserve at the command of the governor so that we can augment the National Guard during state emergencies. And as such, much of our mission and training is aligned with the critical missions of the National Guard, so we are seamless when we fit in with assisting them in meeting the needs of Alaskans at the point of need. We also need to understand the legal authority which creates a State Defense Force. First of all, the ability of the state to have a State Defense Force is found in the United States Constitution. It is also found in the United States Code, Federal Law, 32 U.S. Code 109, and State Defense Forces are regulated by National Guard Bureau Regulation 10-4. In addition, in this state, we have a provision in our Constitution for a State Defense Force. And, of course, we are listed and defined quite a bit in the Military Code Title 26 in the state of Alaska. Our force structure throughout the United States is we have 86 soldiers right now who are volunteering. That's about the same size as the Oregon State Defense Force, the Washington State Defense Force, or the New Mexico State Defense Force. But we have plans to increase those numbers. Their locations are in Fairbanks, Wasilla, Kenai, Valdez, and Juneau, and also in the Joint Operations Center in Anchorage at Jaeger. I want you to know that I'm so proud of the people who serve in the State Defense Force because they are, like you and I, we're citizens of the state. We care about our state. And they donate their time to the state of Alaska, for training, military education, community events, weekend drills, and military exercises. We actually participate in the national exercises up here in a very meaningful way. So when a person joins the State Defense Force, they're required to complete training, attend monthly meetings, weekend drills, and they're subject to military discipline, including the Code of Justice. They may also be ordered into active duty, but when they are in active duty status, they are paid. The State Defense Force is prohibited from receiving any federal funding. That's federal law, of course. And we are a purely state entity. Well, we've gone through a lot of refinement in the Alaska State Defense Force in the last few years, including our training standards have been increased. One of the things that's been very instrumental has been our close association with the Joint Operations Center. So our presence in the Operations Center has meant that we are included in the training, our resources are included in the response to an event, and it also means that when we look at how we're going to train and how we're going to allocate our limited resources, we're going to make sure it's for a highly relevant purpose to the accomplishments of the goals of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. We have a great deal. We have our training is very detailed and ongoing. But to summarize it, I would say that, first of all, we have focused a great deal on communications because Alaska is a state which needs communications very badly. So we focus on radio communications and satellite communications. In fact, we can serve as liaisons from different areas of the state. For example, in Operation Deep Dig, the Joint Operations Center wanted to know, do you have anybody in Cordova? We said no. Do you have anybody in Valdez? Because both these areas were impacted. We said yes. We had both cell phone and the opportunity for radio contact with Valdez, and Valdez responded, yes, we have extremely heavy snow here, but this is an opportunity for our citizens to work. They're making $1,000 to clear one roof, and we're used to snow, and we can handle it. So in that way, we could allocate our resources more properly to Cordova. So that type of liaison work is of value to the state. Our people are trained up in things like the Joint Operations Center basic course, an advanced course, anti-terrorism courses. We have our own officer candidate school, and we also created a new non-commissioned officers academy. We also teach incident command system training to a high to a fairly high level, which results in the qualifications by the individual soldiers to receive the Military Emergency Management Specialist badge. What's been so important to us is the fact that we've been able to integrate our training with the National Guard. We're not out there on our own doing irrelevant things. We are with the National Guard, focused on the state's actual needs. We've participated in almost all of the exercises over the past years, and we're looking forward to Alaska Shield 2016. This last year, 18 of our members were on state active duty for the Alaska fires. In that capacity, they performed individual assistance to victims to assist them in making their claims in any other way they needed. So the trend in the State Defense Force is professionalism, creating standards, and creating a force capable of effectively augmenting the National Guard in support of civil authorities for real-time missions in Alaska. As I mentioned earlier, the current missions of the State Defense Force are very closely aligned with the National Guard. The National Guard is doing those missions, but we have the opportunity to supplement them, to augment them, to allow them to do what they do best. For example, one of the things that happens after a disaster is there should be some kind of a state infrastructure inspection. To that end, last year the State Defense Force created an engineering detachment consisting of professional engineers. This year, matter of fact, later in October this month, the State Guard Association of the United States is putting on an engineering academy for the first time so that professional engineers can come in and learn how to operate within the military environment. What kind of needs does the military have? The State Guard Association of the United States, I would like to mention it just for a minute. It is an association of all the state defense forces throughout the country. And the leadership of those state defense forces is present, including, and actually all ranks are invited to participate. Last year, the State Defense Force hosted the annual conference of the State Guard Association of the United States in Anchorage, which brought revenues to the state. I'm honored and somewhat humbled to be their president this year, and Lieutenant Colonel John James that I just introduced is also an officer of the State Guard Association of the United States. And what we've been doing is creating schools to increase professionalism of state defense forces throughout the United States in chaplaincy, engineering. I'm starting a medical committee now so we can know how to properly mobilize our medical resources. What we're putting on a JAG school for Judge African Generals, attorneys, this year back in Baltimore. So these are exciting times for state defense forces as they step up at a time when resources are shrinking. So perhaps we can be of genuine use to the state of Alaska, and I think we have been. So we do things such as shelter support. If there are victims of a disaster that needs shelter, we could man an armory. Oftentimes we've provided warm tentage for people responding in the scene, out in, you know, not where there's hard buildings to stay in. We've provided warm tentage. We assist in joint staging and reception of incoming out-of-state National Guard troops. I don't know if you've watched through some of these exercises, but you have 3,000 or 4,000 at times fly in, and they have to know how they have to be oriented, after they have the gear board and so forth. We assist the National Guard who does that at the Joint Mobilization Center. We also need to be proficient in field operations. We need to be able to be capable of standing on our own 2 feet out in perhaps even in the woods somewhere while we can address the needs of the people in those locations. One of the things that I've enjoyed so much is supporting the Alaskan Medical Station. That is a portable hospital, which is owned by the state and which is manned by various people, including Samaritan's Purse medical people. But during the last bit of the Guard 2014 earthquake exercise, the State Defense Force was able to provide physicians, nurses. We did the inventory before it was constructed to make sure it's complete. We performed traffic control. We provided communications, and we provided chaplaincy. So the State Defense Force has a typical military organization. We have personnel, intelligence, training and operations, logistics, and communications. But we also have some very, very fine people throughout all the ranks of our State Defense Force, which I'm very proud of. And we also have chaplaincy, as I mentioned, our medical detachment, Staff Judge Advocate General, Engineering. And we have an Inspector General who keeps us all accountable. We engage in the community as well. For example, we support the Wounded Warriors Program with the Kenai Fishing Guides Association, which is a great event for up to 120 to 160 wounded warriors. To come down, the community comes together and we get 2 days of free fishing. We provide a lot of that physical support for that event. For years, we've provided the sound systems for the Special Olympics. We always participate in Operation Stand Down for veterans. And we now, through the State Guard Association Foundation, are providing scholarships for Alaskan students. We awarded $1,000 to Nancy Means, whose father is one of our surgeons. So we also established a color guard for things like the Polynesian Culture Awareness Day, conferences, military ceremonies, and 4th of July parades. So all these things that I just mentioned, other than state active duty, are at no cost to the state. That's all volunteer work. And that speaks to the patriotism of those people who are serving. We've been very fortunate to be recognized in several ways over the past year. Going back to 2013, we were the only state defense force in the nation which received the Meritorious Unit Award for our participation in Arctic Care, which was a DMVA exercise to provide medical, dental, and veterinary care to the villages of Norton Sound. Our Corporal Taylor Cosper, who is, by the way, a graduate of the Alaska Military Youth Academy, was named Soldier of the Year. That's nationally. One person was named Soldier of the Year. He was one of our State Defense Force Corporal, who is now a sergeant, by the way. So we're very proud of him. Our NCO of the year was from Fairbanks, Sergeant First Class Helga Posey. She was recognized as Non-Commissioned Officer of the Year. We're also continually asked to show other states our best practices. They're looking at the State Defense Force in Alaska to learn how to do various tasks well. We've also been recognized. Many were given the Commendation Medal for their participation in Vigilant Guard 14. 18 members were recently awarded the Domestic Emergency Medal for their state active duty during the Alaska fires. We publish articles every issue of Warrior Magazine, so I hope you'll look at those when you have a chance. But what I'd really like to talk about today, I'll get to the conclusion of this, is some changes that are forthcoming in the State Defense Force to make us a more rounded and far more engaged organization. And this the first issue is that in January of 2016, the Alaska State Defense Force will stand up the new 49th Military Police Detachment to support the National Guard's Military Police Company. This effort is a result of ongoing planning to determine how the Alaska Defense Force can best augment the needs of Alaska and the Alaska National Guard during their force reductions. The 49th Military Police Detachment will consist of only qualified law enforcement officers who have been through a police or trooper academy or equivalent military police training. These candidates will have to comply with the Alaska Police Standards Council. Therefore, this armed force will augment and will be trained by the Alaska National Guard. So this is another step in the development of the State Defense Force. It's being done very cautiously, very professionally, and in very close integration with the National Guard. The other thing I would like to point out is that the State Defense Force is in a planning process right now to expand units or detachments or create detachments throughout rural Alaska to engage those communities. And we are proposing new units, new detachments in every region of Alaska. You know, the Alaska State Defense Force provides a very economical approach to rural engagement. For example, the State Defense Force trains in existing armories or local operation centers at no cost, no additional cost. The State Defense Force volunteers are not paid for their training or drill events or community events unless they are specifically put on state active duty for a specific emergency. In that case, they are paid through state funds. I also believe that there's another element here in rural communities, and that is that I believe the rural communities should take pride in the State Defense Force because it has very much in common with the historic Alaska Territorial Guard in concept and operation. For example, the Alaska State Defense Force was initiated and founded by the Adjutant General at the time in 1984, General Edward Pugano. General Pugano was a World War II veteran. He was wounded at Guadalcanal at the age of 19. And he was also an Alaska Native. He is the one who gave the State Defense Force its patch. He gave them the Alaska Territorial Guard patch. That's what he had in mind. To this day, the patch is modified only to reflect that Alaska is now a state rather than a territory. So it says ASDF rather than ATG. Like the old ATG, the State Defense Force is comprised of local volunteer citizens who deeply care about protecting their own communities and the people there. And for the past 30 years, the State Defense Force has served well. That's the history of the State Defense Force, about 31 years now. It served well through natural disasters and the war on terrorism in Alaska after 9/11. To this end of rural engagement, the Alaska State Defense Force will be standing up a signals battalion, a signals detachment in Bethel in January 2016. And we will be looking there for the assistance of some retired National Guardsmen who have that seasoned leadership, who know the community, who will be the leadership in that community. We're going to be inviting them to join the State Defense Force. This will also afford the community an opportunity for those not qualified to be accepted for service under National Guard standards to apply under non-federal different standards. This will also offer the opportunity for those young people in those communities to serve the state and provide leadership and develop leadership skills to assist in protecting their own communities. And these types of skills that the military teaches are also applicable to the workplace. So the Alaska State Defense Force is looking forward to providing opportunities for service in communities throughout Alaska and engaging communities throughout Alaska. That concludes my remarks.
Yes, President Hughes.
Thank you very much, Brigadier General. It's good to put a face with a voice on the phone, and I'm glad the members had a chance to hear this overview, and I'm going to make a confession that even though I've been serving on this committee, I was not really aware that this Defense Force existed, and I've been learning about it the last couple months, and I really believe it's a resource that has, in the last few years, even though they've been doing great work, it's something that we should think about ramping up and strengthening because for a number of reasons, one of them, the budget challenges we'll be facing, as Brigadier General mentioned, these folks are good Alaskan residents. Most, my understanding, are either veterans or retired law enforcement officers. They're professionals. They're doctors. They're attorneys. They're nurses. They're very highly skilled people, and they're volunteering. And my understanding, there's an initial upfront investment of the volunteers' personal funds of about $3,500 to get the gear, to get what they need, and then the drill weekends, the trainings, they're not being paid during that time, and they are just a wonderful resource. And my understanding, Brigadier General, is that at one point it was up to close to 300 strong, and now you mentioned at 86. And I'm very happy to hear the news about the military police detachment and the establishment of the unit in Bethel. So that's good news. I'm just wondering if you'd talk to us about the numbers, if you expect to be recruiting and how you might go about doing that, and do you expect to go up back into the, you know, eventually could we be back up in the 200 range? I think as a state legislator, understanding the history and why, I mean, this goes back to the Minutemen and the Revolution, and because the President of the United States does ultimately have command over our guards, you know, if they're called up to serve out of state. This is, at our state level, you are our defense force. And so as state legislators, I think we have responsibility to make sure you're healthy and robust and able to meet the needs. So I'm just wondering if you'd talk to us about the recruitment numbers.
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Hughes, I would like to address that. The state defense forces throughout the country were established upon the cadre concept. That is that you have the leadership in place with the concept of expanding in the event of a national emergency. I believe that national emergency was felt after 9/11. And that is when the state defense force, which was smaller in its numbers then, grew quite a bit to the real numbers, I've heard the numbers 300. I've looked at the rosters. We actually had an investigation on that, saying, are these real numbers or not? Can the governor really rely on these numbers? And so when I came on board, we answered that question. We said, no, those Lawless, yes, they were in the State Defense Force at one time, but they're not really active now. So we need to, and we pared down to about 109 at that time. This is going back 6-7 years ago. Then we did something else. When I became commander, I did notice that I thought that we needed to really maintain military standards. And so that is when we started the, if somebody wanted to be an officer, they really needed to go through an officer candidate school. If somebody wanted to be a non-commissioned officer, they needed to go through the non-commissioned officer school. I'd consulted with other states before I did that. Is this a good idea? They said, it's a very good idea, but you're going to lose people. You're going to have washouts, just like in the regular military. And we did have some washouts. The remaining force, though, for example, the remaining force is excellent. And the people who spent the time to become qualified to do their jobs has meant, for example, for me personally, that I have an outstanding G staff that can really do their job. And when we say we have so many people, we really have them. They can really go. Having said all that, I am seeking to expand the State Defense Force in several manners. First of all, by developing new mission sets so we can be more valuable to the state. That is why we are building on our medical. We are building on our engineering. We're building our chaplains. We're seeking, we're creating new categories of communications services that we can provide, because those kinds of activities attract a certain type of person. We're starting the MP detachment. We're starting the rural engagement, and that is an exciting process. And while we're still in the planning stage, you know, I envisage that we will be looking at each region of the state, and year by year we'll be adding new detachments. That's my goal. So this is where we're going with expanding the State Defense Force, expanding it in numbers and expanding it geographically.
Follow up? And so when you say expanding it in numbers and geographically, do you have a certain number of years and certain numbers you're aiming for, or
we're on a 3-to-5-year plan. Right now we're looking at the next 5 years, and we're taking 1 year at a time right now. We're saying, can we really resource this? For example, in Bethel, we will be spending money on that, because we want them to be successful up there. We want them to have the proper communications equipment, the uniforms. We don't want them spending We don't want them spending anything of their own money. We want them to be successful. We're going to provide, while we're focusing on local leadership, we're also going to be transporting our own people up there for training purposes, to train and to organize. And so, actually, it's a fairly economical process even at that, but that's an exciting prospect. Now, we're going to start out small. Somebody walked up to me the other day and they said, when something is born, they're not 6'5", they're little. I had to chuckle at that, with that person, but it's true. When you start something, it starts small, but great things happen with a small detachment, small unit tactics and so forth. So we're going to start a signals detachment to start off with. And we have maybe 4 or 5 people that are known who would be the initiators of that. And so, and as the detachment grows with people, then we can start adding new mission sets to keep growing. That's our goal.
Thank you.
Permission to briefly supplement. The department, if you look at Lieutenant Colonel John James in the second row, he's the Lieutenant Colonel with the Bronze Star. He didn't get that in the Alaska State Defense Force. He's a retired active duty military officer, served with the Army in Afghanistan. Before that, he was enlisted, where he served as a parachute instructor, which is very important to have the right standards, or you start dropping people without the chute opening. He spent 8 years in Western Alaska as an active Army advisor to the National Guard in training. We have him on full-time right now, state active duty for this year. in terms of enabling and facilitating this plan going forward. He knows what we need to train up a new group, as he saw with the National Guard in rural Alaska. He has the expertise in training and standards. That's why he's here today. That's why we have him on full-time. We're also committing some funds with, that we're able to scrape across the department to enable travel out to those areas, as we primarily target veterans right now, is to build that core group in Bethel in January, and hopefully you'll be there, Representative Heron. It's about 4 days before the session starts, and we go forward from there.
And follow-up?
Okay, we only have about a half an hour, so go ahead.
Right, and I know, because I would enjoy an entire hearing on this so we could dig in deeper, and I know we don't have that time, but if you could just mention how the budget, I understand the budget in the past has been roughly about $30,000 a year, which is pretty small, and how that might be impacted. And then I just want to make a comment. I'm glad about the military police detachment being formed. You mentioned it would just be retired law enforcement officers, and I'm wondering, some, as I've looked at what other states have done, there are some states that have armed defense forces and some that don't, and my understanding there has been that's been limited here more recently in recent years, and if we're thinking about going back and wondering why a veteran who is trained with arms and such, you know, why you wouldn't have them be in that detachment. I know you talked about the Police Standards Council, et cetera, but I was just wondering the arming of the defense force. I think that's important, and so just to make comment there about the budget and the military police and veterans being part of that.
Yes. First of all, as to the budget, the budget was $30,000 for many, many years. I think 30 years ago it was about $26,000. But this year, the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs has increased that to $50,000. And so that is, that increase, and this has just happened very recently, so that increase is going to help enormously. And, you know, like some other organizations, everybody wants more money all the time, but we have a lot of things provided for us. For example, we have places to drill. We have our utilities. We have our phones paid. That's not in our budget because we're using existing facilities. So that cuts down on the overhead tremendously. And while we are truly a volunteer force, because that is what state defense forces do, we are also paid from other funds during actual disasters like the Alaska fires. So that all helps as well. So this new monetary amount is has been very important to us and is enabling the new region to be developed. So that's very important.
Thank you, General. Representative Lynn and then Representative Gruenberg.
Well, just quickly, I think you mentioned it before, but what is the total population today of the Defense Force?
We have 86 at this time.
86 officers and enlisted both.
Officer enlisted, yes. And it's more, it's based more on a cadre unit, which means that we have our officers and NCOs in place, and we love to encourage young people to come as well. But a lot of times these young people have to work on Saturdays and things like that. So we're always looking for new ways to engage people, to be flexible, to try to get them in.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. General Gruenberg?
Thank you. General, maybe, and I don't hear so well, maybe I missed something. I want to follow up on the military police thing.
Would you maybe start from square one? Is this going to be a new unit or what, General?
It will be a new detachment located at Alcantara Armory.
Where's that?
That's in Wasilla.
Okay.
And that is a National Guard armory, state-owned. And that is where the National Guard's military police battalion is right now. They're expecting that to be downsized to a company. And so this is an opportunity for the State Defense Force to augment them. As I mentioned, the type of individual that is going to be part of this military police detachment assigned to the National Guard's military police company will be people who meet the Alaska Police Standards Council requirements. In other words, they've been through an academy, like the Trooper Academy. We actually have a current trooper who wants to join. Or they've been through another police academy. But they're, after 9/11, we armed everyone in the State Defense Force. And we had a lesser standard. We were constables. And the concept of constable was that you're not really quite a police officer. You're something less than that, but you can report to the troopers or whatever. We were always under military command. And we guarded a lot of infrastructure, and thank goodness we didn't have any problems. But the liability was enormous. When you think of how police interact with the public on a daily basis and the calls they need to make.
I don't mean to interrupt you,
yeah.
But we're short on time here. About how many people will be in this detachment?
We anticipate 4 or 5 to begin with.
And when they downsize the current battalion to a company, how many people will be out of a position?
I'm not so sure. Colonel James might know. I don't know.
You'll have to come to the mic, please.
For the record, Lieutenant Colonel John James, Alaska State Defense Force, through the chair. I'm developing that plan right now. My current is to establish that detachment with 3 personnel to provide leadership for the detachment.
3.
3 right now. And then in the near future, yet to be determined, about 9. So we have about a squad.
What I'm wondering is if we already have people who are in that battalion, would they be eligible to come into that as well? Because obviously they have an interest and a commitment.
Yes, Representative. The State Defense Force is holistically a part of the Alaska National Guard, a part of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, but we are different and we're separate and under Title 32 in Alaska State Statute 26 as opposed to being a federal force. So there's differences there. If those soldiers were separated or ETS'd out of the Alaska National Guard, I think they would be an excellent resource if they chose to leave the National Guard to that time, perhaps join the State Defense Force. That's it right now, sir.
If I may.
Would you mind, Mr. Chairman? The short answer on where we don't have positions for military placement, we believe we will have other positions within the National Guard.
Oh.
It may require some retraining, but we will keep them as a dual asset available to the state.
May I ask one more question, please? Is there going to be anything that we need to do as a legislature, either statutorily or budget-wise, to help facilitate this?
Through the chair, we're exploring the range of an increment right now within the administration. I believe it will be quite modest. We are also looking at some provisions dealing with workers' comp coverage that I think would be appropriate that we're also exploring and will be presenting shortly.
Mr. Chair, maybe that could be to us.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, I have a real just a quick tad to follow up.
Representative Hughes.
Will those 3 to 9 that are part of that detachment be the only ones that are armed and the rest of the Defense Force not be armed, or could you tell us what the status of those would be?
Yes, I can. yes, they will be the ones who are armed right now, but what we do is we cyclically look and review what the needs of the state are. For example, if we had an armed imminent armed invasion of the United States or Alaska, I'm sure things would change very quickly. Right now, we're dealing primarily with disasters, so that's not quite where we're going with it right now.
And so when they do the drills, though, they are training with weapons, so they're always would be ready if there were need for them to be armed. And my understanding is they have an amazing track record, so I understand the liability issue, but I think that could be worked through. And I would say even in disaster, sometimes things can get tense. People can be quite upset, and I'm just kind of thinking if some states have their entire defense forces armed, there's a reason, and that's something that Alaska should be considering at all times, not just if there were an invasion.
Okay, thank you. We have one more set to go, and then we have public testimony, so thank you very much, General.
Mr. Chairman, Deputy Commissioner Dole again. If it assists the committee, Mr. Jones is a captive audience. He can brief you all during lunch at the AMIA facility, or he can do it.
Well, might as well give us a preface. No sense excluding anyone.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and esteemed members of the legislature. It's great to be here. My name is James Jones. I'm the Deputy Director of the Alaska Military Youth Academy Challenge Program located on Joint Base Commodore Richardson and Camp Carroll. And I'm here to just briefly talk about the Military Youth Academy and its mission. The Challenge Program in itself was established after a 1989 Rockefeller Foundation study determining where the threats were domestically. And we know that the military deals with threats foreign and domestic, but the domestic threat here in the United States was the dropout population. And as of the last accounting in 2013, approximately 1 million young men and women do not complete high school, which means about 20% of those who go into high school do not complete high school. And statistics show that every 26 seconds a young person drops out of high school. So the Military Youth Academy was established and began its operation January 30th, 1994, for the purpose of helping Alaska address the dropout population. As far as the mission statement is concerned, it is the primary purpose of the Alaska Military Youth Academy to help intervene in the lives of at-risk youth and provide graduates with values, skills, education, and self-discipline to succeed as adults. And so we deal with a population of approximately 4,000 reported dropouts here in the state of Alaska. The program's vision is to be recognized as the premier education institution within the state to attract and retain and serve youth who are at risk of not receiving a secondary education. And we know that when a young person does not receive their education, when they do not complete the things that they start, it becomes a drain on society. So our aim and our mission is to make sure that that doesn't happen. I'm always excited about the opportunity to talk about the Academy. I've been with the program for 19 years, and over the last 19 years, I've seen quite a few things occur. But just to give you a brief overview of a typical day in the life of a young person, when they come on board, and we just received a new class 2 weeks ago, when they come on board, the day after we get everyone on campus, we do what we call a gentle nudging, or we call it shock and dock. And it's a military-style engagement of all the students with the staff in a way to motivate them and help them understand that we're in a completely different environment. And we know that environment is one of those factors that affects the belief system. And the environment that we have is called quasi-military, which means it's not a boot camp, it's not a juvenile justice facility, it's not a treatment facility. The environment is designed to use the best practices of the military with a structure to help a young person engage in a mindset as they begin to think about what things they want to accomplish in life. And we give them that opportunity by taking away all the distractions. So there are no cell phones, no pagers, no Xboxes. At least we have those there, but those are, if you will, those are benefits if they accomplish certain things. But as far as using them every day, we have young men and women who are engaged in physical activity. They're engaged in their education, and we do a lot of things to help them be successful in life. We're a 17-and-a-half-month program, of which 5.5 months is in residence 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on Camp Carroll. We also have staff that provides medical services, nursing services. We have educators. We have a certified GED test center, which is only one of two GED test centers, I understand, in the state of Alaska since the GED program changed in January of 19 of last year. Only UAA and Alaska Military Youth Academy are certified to provide GED services. We're also certified as a WorkKEYS testing site since the Department of Labor and Workforce Development's program did some transition. We are now certified to provide our students with the ability to take the Work Keys assessment. We also provide every one of our students the opportunity to take the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery, which is called the ASVAB, so that they can assess where they are, and if they want to go into the military, they can go into the military. So we do a lot of things to help prep them for the military service if that's what they choose to do. Presently, we have 153 students on the campus, and this year alone, our students in the two classes that graduated in both February and August performed over 21,000 hours of service to the community. This is just giving back to the community with no compensation other than a thank you, and we appreciate the things that you've done to give back into the community. Our educational component provides an opportunity for students to receive credit recovery so that if they have credits they did not accomplish while they were in high school, they can recover those credits through our online credit recovery. They can obtain a GED and understand that the GED test is completely different than it was when it first began. And the new iteration that came on board in January of 2014 has made it more difficult for students to obtain the GED. So if you were to take a look at the numbers of GED certificates that were awarded in 2013 as opposed to 2014, you would see a significant drop because of the degree of difficulty. The new GED program, our new GED testing, helps for career readiness and vocational testing and college readiness. We're number five in the nation. There are 35 challenge programs nationwide in 27 states, D.C. and Puerto Rico. And as we already indicated, our dropout population and the numbers are the young people that we take in are between the ages of 16 and 18. They can have no significant felony criminal history. They're drug and alcohol free. They can be underemployed or unemployed. Just to give you, since I'll get the opportunity to talk with you on the bus, and I have two cadets that will be riding back, just to give you just some anecdotal stories of some of our successful graduates. We have, and I want to talk about three. We have one young man who was a graduate of our program some years ago. He's from Wasilla, Alaska. This young man's name is Andrew Mitchell. And Andrew Mitchell came to us at age 16. 1 year later, after he graduated and turned 17, the day after his 17th birthday, he decided to go into the Marine Corps. And Andrew, during boot camp in the Marine Corps, received a call from his drill sergeant that he had a special assignment. And he knew as a brand new Marine recruit that when you hear such special assignment, you usually mean go clean the toilet or something like that. Well, for Andrew, this was a little bit different. Andrew had been chosen to serve in a special duty assignment as a mechanic on Marine One under the Bush administration. So for his first duty assignment, Andrew Mitchell served on Marine One, and we got a chance to see him on a couple occasions going back east. And when the president stopped in to J-Bear, Andrew was able to facilitate several of our cadets going in for a backstage tour with the First Lady. Mm-hmm. So that's some of what we have. We also have a young man who is currently, his last name is Huff. He is currently a sophomore at the U.S. Military Academy of West Point. And he was an Army Guardsman, graduated from the Military Youth Academy in 2010. And after serving in the Army Guard, chose and applied for and received an appointment to the U.S. Military Academy. So he's doing well. The last person I want to talk about is just a young lady who graduated some years ago. Her name is Tia Luttrell McCormick. And Tia Luttrell was a Miss Anchorage back in the early 2000s. And Tia Luttrell is a flight attendant with United Airlines, but she's also now a business owner, doing very well and successful in Las Vegas. She didn't do a business up here in Alaska, but she got her start here. But those are just some of the 4,665 students who've graduated from our program since the program began.
Well, James, many a graduate has returned to the region that I represent, and it works. That's just the bottom line. And I'm glad that
this state sees the wisdom in having the academy.
Thank you.
Thank you for your service. Any other questions?
I'll ask them on the bus.
Any concluding remarks before we do the rest of the day?
Just again, on behalf of DMBA, we want to thank the committee for its time and attention and the opportunity to meet with you all today. Dr. Jones did sell his program a little short on recent accomplishments. In this last class, going through shock indoctrination, they set a new record for retention, keeping the most Alaskans on that positive vector change through some leadership by him and Director Rose's to just revisit how they are doing business and continually improve.
Well, on behalf of the committee, I want to thank everyone, we do appreciate you, the work you do and the service to the state and to the country, and I thank you very much. Yes, Representative Gruenberg.
Could I make a slight announcement?
Go ahead.
It's with some deep regret that I'd like to let the folks know that Marcy Book, who was the wife of former Representative Bob Book from Sand Lake, just died. And I think a lot of us certainly knew Bob, know Bob, and knew Marcy. The funeral's going to be on Saturday, I'm not sure, at Glory Day Lutheran Church. And the obits in the Daily, in the Dispatch News today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. So, Commissioner, where do you want us and for the rest of the tour?
I believe we have a bus waiting outside.
Outside? At 12:15?
Yes, that's great.
Okay. Before we do that, we do have one person that wants to testify. His name is Robert McGill. He's calling in from Fairbanks. Sir, are you on the line?
Yes, sir. I'm going to apologize first off because I'm not a polished public speaker, so I'll just say what I have to say and hope you guys will all bear with me. As you well know, a few months or a little while ago, we had four guardsmen killed in Tennessee. Since then, Tennessee's armed their guardsmen. I live in North Pole, and I went to Fairbanks to the Alaska National Guard. Those guys were sitting in there behind locked glass doors. Nobody's packing a weapon. I found out that they can pack a weapon without new rules and laws being passed if the guard so chooses to. All these guys are recruiters or sergeants or above, and during my time in the military, I never met a sergeant or an NCO that was an idiot. We train them to use weapons, we send them overseas to let them get killed. We bring them home, make recruiters out of them, and then we take their weapons away from them because, oh my God, we might scare somebody with an NCO walking around with a 45 or 9mm strapped on. I would like somebody to make the decision to arm our guardsmen so they can protect themselves if something happens, like what happened in Tennessee. If nothing happens, I guess I'm going to go to one state senator I know and to newspapers and everybody else and see if I can bring some pressure on somebody to do something. We're only trying to protect our own people here, and that's all I got to say. Sorry about that.
Hey, Mr. McGill, thanks for your comments. Duly noted, and we'll pass that message along to the governor. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Okay, thank you.
Seeing no other, we're concluded the morning session at 12:05, and please board the buses at 12:15 if you're joining us. Thank you.